I'm Carlos Virgen, and this is The Storyline, produced by The Day in New London, Connecticut. On this week's episode of The Storyline, reporter Sten Spinella talks to Connecticut College economics professor Monica Lopez-Anuarbe about how long-standing healthcare and economic disparities have exacerbated the COVID-19 pandemic for communities of color, and in particular, the Hispanic community.
It must be strange for you right now, where, you know, a lot of the things that your research has revolved around has kind of come to the fore. Is it strange for you to see these topics you've been focusing on, I guess, become magnified?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are definitely very strange times that we're living in. They're very unprecedented. But I think that it's important that these topics have been highlighted and exacerbated, because that might mean that sometimes when we are in a crux or in a crisis is when we actually act and do something about it, right? So instead of kind of knowing about it, now it's out there. So what are we going to do? And just like we see with the marches that are happening nationwide, right, it's not just about screaming, but it's about some policy change. I'm hoping that the fact that everything is out in the open makes us be more aware, and not just be aware, but actually do something about it. So I'm actually very happy that these topics are more public, more mainstream than they were before. And it's not just a bunch of, researchers on the side that are doing this, but that it's in that people are talking about these topics at their dinner tables. Right. It's not an academic exercise anymore.
Yeah. 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 Good point. And, something that we have struggled with in our newsroom.
Yeah.
Is the demographic data has been, if not non-existent, very small.
Yes.
And like the CT Mirror recently reported that the death rate for Hispanics is 67% higher than for white residents from COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that this has been the case in other health issues, that COVID-19 is not an exception. Could you comment on that? And we'll get to the data part later, but just it does seem,
yeah.
Black residents are 2.5 times more likely to die from a coronavirus
right.
infection than whites. So tell me about that, why that might be the case, and if that's so different from, other health issues that face every community.
Absolutely. So Hispanics have very interesting contradictions in the United States, right? So first of all, I want to just make sure that we highlight that the term Hispanic was coined by the census in the 70s, right? And that we or they come from over 20 countries, right? With very different immigration histories, wealth levels, racial ethnicity, power, class, et cetera, right?
Yeah, it's a reductive
and yet,
term.
Right? Yeah. So, for example, what does someone from Buenos Aires, Argentina, from high have to do with someone from Cuba, right? So they're very different histories, so that's important. Nevertheless, when Hispanics come to the United States, at the aggregate level, there are some pervasive socioeconomic disparities, right, that unfortunately characterize a majority of people. So the interesting thing about Hispanics is that at the aggregate level, there are they usually have lower wealth levels, lower education levels than the average white. And yet they have what is known as the Hispanic paradox, which means that they tend to outlive whites, right? So what's going on, right? So they tend to outlive whites, even in the United States. Now, this paradox, unfortunately, as Hispanics assimilate and transition from becoming immigrants to Americans, right, residents, then just because you live longer doesn't mean you're healthier, right? So you have, you live longer, but you also have really high levels of morbidity, and right? So mortality might be lower, but then you're just sicker longer. So that's not cool either, right? Who wants to live 40 years sick? Yeah. So that is basically, those are basically some of the issues. So you have Hispanics dying later, but sometimes, you know, with higher rates of hypertension, diabetes, now increasing rates of obesity that maybe weren't present before. And then if you add on top of that, the disparities in access to healthcare, right, health insurance, then these disparities and inequities are exacerbated because not only are they sicker, but then they have less access to a increasingly expensive healthcare system. When you look at all of that and then you add a pandemic, right, to add insult to injury, then all of those disparities are highlighted in an exponential form, right? Because sometimes you can be sick and if you can go to the hospital, to the ER, but if you are poor and sick and now you can't go to the ER anymore because it is saturated, right, then your disadvantage shows even more than before.
When we have wanted to do, I guess, reporting on demographics and how different groups are being affected differently, we haven't really been able to find data. There is some statewide data, but like, in terms of, you know, New London County specifically, how important is that demographic data? And I don't know if you know this, but do you have any idea why it's so difficult for the state to collect?
Yes, absolutely. Right. So let's see. Our state has over 40,000 cases of confirmed COVID, right? Okay. Over 4,000 deaths. Then New London County has more or less 900 cases, about 68 deaths. And the city of New London, about 150 to 200 cases, right? And that's it. That's what we know, right? Which is terrible because, so there are two reasons why I have very little on minorities, right? One of them is that if you look at research, it's Hispanics, for example, right, are not the main research question of research, right? So there are these biases in research where we keep on asking the same questions over and over again and not allowing certain groups that that are already underrepresented in research to flourish and surface, right? So there's just a research bias preference, right? So that's one thing. The second one might be that even if we want to research a minority or a vulnerable population, we do it in such a way that it's impossible for this population to participate, right? Because maybe we say, okay, you got to come between 3 and 5 p.m., and people are working, right? They don't have childcare, right? So the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? So you want to do research on these populations, and then you're just doing a terrible job at the outreach part, right? Okay, because you're not considering the reality of the people that you want to study. Okay, so that's problem number two, right? So preference, just good intentions, bad execution. And then there's also a mistrust, number three, right? Where people are sometimes afraid to participate in research because, you know, for example, the census. If you look at the census participation rate in New London, it's much below the Connecticut state average and the national state average, okay? Why is that? Well, because, you know, for example, in New London, about 30% of the population is Hispanic. And I'm sure that not everybody has their legal status the way that the government wants the legal status to be. So for a while, there was this kind of campaign at the federal level saying that we are going to be asking you these questions of whether are you a permanent resident, et cetera. And so that's just terrifying, right? If you look at African Americans historically, right, there were all these research projects that went really bad where they were guinea pigs of certain experimental treatments that were awful, right? So there's also a bit of mistrust and fear. So in those three, I think, are the main reasons why we have such crappy data for minorities, right? Lack of interest, you know, bad intentions, and a mistrust.
I want to ask you about this New London case study from 2017. And I know the Day wrote a story about that. So, I mean, that goes to this point specifically. You and another researcher finding from your research that there is a problem in reaching out to, you know, Hispanic families and talk about long-term care planning in New London.
We conducted some quantitative and qualitative research at the national level, but also for New London, right? Again, to once again highlight a particular area and not use ethnicity as a control variable in a study, right? Like as part of the equation. Also, just it's all about Hispanics, right? And not just talking about everything and then talking about nothing. And in this particular study, there are some of the literature was suggesting that Hispanics in general don't plan. Almost like a stereotypical thing, like just don't plan, right? Just wing it. And so what we wanted to see was whether that was true, right? Is it that Hispanics just wing it and don't plan for long-term care specifically, right? Or is the story much more complex than that, as it often is, right? So in this case, what we did was we actually said, instead of just looking at data set that is impersonal, what about collecting our own data, right? Primary data in which we can see the face of who we are interviewing and their body language and how they react to questions. So we conducted 6 focus groups in English and in Spanish with about 35 to 40 participants. And we asked some questions about, you know, like, what do you view as aging? How are you planning for long-term care, et cetera, right? And we decided to do it in focus groups because they're kind of like public interviews. And sometimes what one person says encourages or discourages someone else to participate, right? So there are all these really interesting dynamics going on of who dominates the conversation, who doesn't, right? And it turned out that, of course, Hispanics plan, of course. It's just that the definition of planning might be very narrow as we speak, right? So is planning, you know, putting your money on a nest egg for a 401k, right? Well, that would be lovely, except that if you don't have the money, you can't put it in any nest egg because it's too expensive, right? So why don't we broaden our definition of what planning means before we judge whether someone plans or doesn't plan, right? And what we also found out is that there's also this kind of common idea that that the government doesn't really need to help Hispanics with their long-term care needs because the families are so tight and so awesome, so loving, and they're all set, right? So they can just take care of their stuff. So why should we get involved? And we actually realized that that is a big lie, right? That Hispanic families are just as vulnerable as any other family in terms of the challenges of what it really means to care for, say, an aging individual, right? It's expensive for everybody. You know, if you look at Connecticut, it costs about $300 to $400 a day. Multiply that times 30, multiply that times 365. So if you, you know, don't die of a disease, you're going to die of a heart attack when you get the bill, right? What you have to pay. And so what happened, what we realized was that Hispanic families are highly strained and they do need the help of public and private entities. Yeah. And that they are very resilient and very creative in how they take care of each other. Right. But that there's a loud cry for help. And after we did a lot of these studies, then we realized that one of the needs is they need information, right? Not just generic one, but concrete one that says, okay, I need a dentist for my grandfather who speaks Spanish. Where do I get that? Right. As opposed to just talking about Medicare and Medicaid in a like stratosphere, just very abstract way. So that's what we're working on now. We're creating a bilingual website for Hispanic caregivers in New London. And that's it. Right. Nobody else. Well, maybe Southeastern Connecticut. Right. OK, but very concrete so that we actually provide specific tools to specific people.
This is something else that I wanted to ask you about, because I remember reporting on and, you know, interacting with CT Students for a Dream when I was a UConn student. Mm-hmm. This idea of a bill expanding Husky. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Can you tell me more about this and why you think it's necessary?
Absolutely. So basically what I partner up with the Connecticut Health Foundation, right, to conduct a cost-benefit analysis of why it makes sense to expand Husky for immigrants regardless of their status, right? Because the word immigrant sometimes gets muddled with status, right? So, I mean, most of us were immigrants at some point in their time. But, you know, when you say immigrant, you're like, okay, right? So they don't have their papers or their documentation, right? But here, actually, we don't care. The idea is we don't even ask, do you have, some kind of legal status? It's for everybody. And the reason behind this, and of course, the problem with this study is that costs and benefits have different timelines. Right. So sometimes the problem of any cost benefit analysis is that the costs are usually upfront and the benefits are nonlinear, and maybe they happen in 10 years. And by then, maybe the politician in charge is not there anymore. So they don't reap the benefits of, but they do have to engage in the costs. Right. So nobody wants to be altruistic because there are different political and social agendas happening. So that's basically what we're trying to do. We're trying to convince the state of Connecticut that it actually does pay off to have a healthier population, no matter their status, because as you can see, these are very contagious times. And the virus is not going to be asking, what's your legal status, to see whether you get whether you get sick or not, right? So if you have a healthier population, the benefits are going to happen, and the incubation periods are going to be smaller, right? So this is a public health emergency. And once again, before COVID, nobody wanted to deal with this, right? But now that people are actually being affected, that people that you know are being affected, people reconsider even universal healthcare, right? As a viable, not as expensive as we thought it was alternative. You know, if you look at people, they're losing their jobs, right? So does it make sense for your boss to give you healthcare? If you lose your job, does that mean that you have to be sick, right? So all these like weird socialist, scary ideas all of a sudden don't seem so silly anymore when they affect more people than just the ones outside of our bubble of privilege.
I'm interested, this ongoing research you're doing about Hispanic caregivers during the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean,
yeah,
obviously caregivers are in a really difficult situation right now. as is basically anybody who has to work amongst other people at the moment. I mean, I think you and I are lucky in a way that we get to work from home during this.
Absolutely.
So why focus on Hispanic caregivers? What gave you the idea to look into this? And I know it's probably in the beginning stages, but if you've learned anything thus far, please impart to me what you've found.
Of course. Absolutely. So this project, of course, you know, is at its incipient stages, right? We just started. But we've applied for a grant, to develop. And the grant is precisely acknowledging the fact that because there is such a dearth of data on minorities, right? So how can we increase that data collection? And moreover, how can we increase that data collection in the times of social distancing, right? Where you can't even conduct research the way that you were used to for decades. So what we've suggested is creating some kind of online questionnaire, right, for caregivers, for Hispanic caregivers, to ask them these questions. Because if you think about caregiving, right, it's a very high touch task, right? You got to bathe that person, right? You got to feed them. But at the same time, it's not very highly valued either in terms of society, right? So maybe society might value a basketball player, right? Or a journalist such as yourself, or a professor, but a caregiver, no, it's not really like a cool thing to be. And then that's also correlated with the salary, right? So the wages are usually really low. That's even if you're paid, right? Never mind if you're an unpaid caregiver, if you're just doing it because you love that person, right? And then, and how do you socially distance when you still have to go and shop for that person, right? You have to go to the supermarket to engage in food security for that person, right? They need to eat, and you can't always order everything on Amazon Prime, right? So basically, that's basically, those were the things that we wanted to know. Like, what is working for you? What is not working with you? What are the creative ways in which you are trying to deal with this, right? Because it's not, I don't want it to be a study where we're just being very paternalistic and telling people what to do and, right, and victimizing caregivers. I'm very allergic to that, right? Sometimes, you know, the lessons that you learn come from the vulnerable populations much more, and they give you a slap in the face and, you know, in terms of humility, right? So what is working and how can we help, right? Of course, once again, we don't want to deal with a questionnaire that nobody answers because nobody trusts us. So we are distributing it with established, trusted organizations such as the Connecticut Health Foundation, Hispanic Alliance of Southeastern Connecticut, English and in Spanish, right, to eliminate any types of barriers of language and culture. And we also are providing a symbolic financial token, you know, $20. It's not a big deal. Nobody's going to get rich from answering our, but just to say we value your time, right? Okay. We're not just going to freely collect your information for our benefit as researchers, right? Here is something because we value you, and let's value you financially too, right? In a symbolic way, but just to bring up the issue of the need to for the government actually to compensate caregivers as well. Okay, why is it that their time doesn't mean any financial compensation, for example?
What do you think Southeastern Connecticut or the state, you know, whether you want to bring this home locally or talk about it statewide, what can they do to help aging Hispanic populations or aging or Hispanic populations during the pandemic? And do you think that there's you know, areas of the state and the region has missed the mark.
Right. Yes. Yes. So, with the Connecticut Health Foundation, I'm in a task force in which we're trying to prioritize, right, at the 3 month level, 6 months, 1 year, what are those priorities? What are we missing? Where are we going, et cetera? And I think that there are, in terms of, let's say, so what are the hot spots of the state, the region, and the country, right? So one of them is nursing homes, as you know, right? There are some very specific ways in which we can diminish the more fatality cases, right? So, for example, what I noticed when visiting some of these nursing homes is that the care worker had a mask, but the patient did not, right? And so there are some very simple things that we can do in terms of just not doing things the way we've always done them, because this is a virus that we don't know a lot about, honestly, right? Some people initially were minimizing it, linking it to the flu. Others were really catastrophizing it, right? And it's neither one nor the other, right? But there are certain practices that we can do in terms of public health that we can engage in. And in terms of Hispanics, I think that outreach is key. Outreach is key. Outreach that is not culturally clumsy, right? That is not patronizing, that is effective, right? Simple, less is more, right? Sometimes when I read these websites, they give me a headache, and I have a PhD in this, right? I mean, I don't understand what they're trying to say. That's not right. It's just less is always more if it's about quality, right? So once we get through the initial stages of collecting data, right, which is what we're working on right now, and prioritizing, I think that it's very important to always reach out to the people that you're trying to help, right? Because if it all stays at the theoretical level, then there's no point. There's no point in collecting data for the sake of collecting data, is what I'm trying to say, right? There have to be specific policies. And just like I gave you the example of the mask, right? There are very, very simple things that we can do that can have a huge impact and that don't really cost that much money.
Last question for you. I think it's another big one. I saved those for the end.
Good.
You know, just in general, how do you think the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, has impacted Hispanic populations differently than white people in the state?
Right. Well, I think the pandemics have simply impacted Hispanic populations and elderly more. That's it, right? More because of all of the embedded vulnerabilities, right? So what is a pandemic? So a pandemic has to do with health, okay? And if you have a population that is sicker, then their health is going to be compromised a lot more, okay? What else happens in a pandemic? Well, if you get person A getting sick, person B getting sick, same level of disease, right? But person A has access to healthcare and person B does not, right? Then one is going to have an advantage over the other. So we have sicker people with lower access to healthcare, lower levels of insurance, higher morbidity levels, lower socioeconomic status, then it's just, we're just checking the boxes of everything that could go wrong, right? And it's not, I don't want to sound dramatic, right? But these stats are showing it, right? Okay, it's not a hypothesis made by some quack professor. The death rates are showing it, the number of cases are showing it, that when you have all that combined into one, the health inequities are much higher, and the cases will also reflect that reality.
Yeah. Professor, is there anything that you want to add that I didn't touch on, you know, regarding this conversation? Doesn't even have to be about New London County, just
right.
Anything that I missed?
In general, I just think that after we survive this pandemic, which we will, hopefully, I'm just hoping that we don't go back to our old ways, right? That we actually learn something, and not just learn it from an intellectual perspective, but from a policy perspective. That, again, you can't fix everything, but choose a few things and then really, really improve them, right? At the personal level and at the local level and at the policy level. So I'm hoping that, you know, something good comes out of these pandemics, right? In terms of how we interact with people, how we judge them, how we deal with our, how we actually realize that even though we do have different lives, and even though the state of Connecticut is experiencing COVID differently, I'm looking at the data, and some counties have 300 cases, right? And some counties have, I'm thinking Fairfield, 15,000 cases, right? So obviously our experience is going to be different. But what I'm just hoping is that people realize that their experience is not the global experience, that you have to be open to the fact that the way that I live things is not the way that everybody lives things, and hopefully have more compassion, and compassion not just for the sake of feeling better about yourself and thinking that you're awesome, but compassion in the way that we prioritize policy, healthcare, and solutions.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast on Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you use Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps us reach more people. Thanks for listening.